My friend, I'm so glad you could join us. It's been such a long time since we spoke. Thank you for accepting my invitation. Not many people have the stomach for this midnight sailing. But well, what can I say? It appeals to my sense of the dramatic. Shall we go below decks? The voyage... Oh, this ship doesn't go anywhere in particular, you understand. At least, not in any sense that you would understand. But let's discuss that some other time. I've asked you aboard tonight because I've turned up some really quite remarkable and true ghost stories from Irish history, and I thought you might like to hear them. You'll take a brandy, of course. Good for the sea legs. Now... Sit down over there. The story I have to relate is one of the most remarkable I've ever come across, both for the number of witnesses who attest to it and for its location. For it happened in a police barracks, and the witnesses were all hard-nosed, not to say hard-headed, members of the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Now, many disturbing events have happened in police barracks throughout Ireland, but for the most part, they were all too readily explicable by, well, human frailty or all too human hatreds. But in late 1945, the Royal Ulster Constabulary Barracks at Letter, near Pettigo, witnessed events which had no obvious explanation on this plane of existence. Pettigo sits right on the border between Northern Ireland and what was, in 1945, the Irish Free State. Cross the bridge onto High Street and you cross from County Donegal to County Fermanagh, from the Irish state to the United Kingdom. Follow the road south from Pettigo and you'll cross the border again into Northern Ireland. Yes, it's one of those places where travelling south takes you north, to its satellite village of Achnablaney. And about 2 miles from there, as the crow flies, sits Boa Island in the middle of Loch Earn. The crow being the appropriate measure here. Boa Island is named after Baive, the ancient Irish goddess of war, who often, so it's said, takes the form of a crow when she comes to foreshadow death and destruction. It's not the scene of our story, but let's tarry a while here on Boa Island. Weathered by the rains of centuries, within its graveyard are two mysterious, inscrutable, and very, very old stone figures. What fear, what dread, what awe must have inspired an ancient sculptor to carve the more famous figure, an Irish Janus, a figure with two faces looking in opposite directions, each with weirdly elongated eyes and a tongue protruding from each mouth. Whom or what does it represent? Nobody knows, nor will they ever, but here it has sat, with both faces gazing out to sea, for almost 2,000 years. In August 1945, just as the Second World War was fully ending, and just before our story begins, a macabre discovery was made on the shores of Boa Island by Sergeant MacNeil of the RUC, the very man who would be confronted with the Letter Barracks haunting just a month later. I'm not sure that the connection between Sergeant MacNeil's eerie discovery and his later role in the barracks haunting has ever been forged in the 80 years since. You may be the first to take it under consideration. So, consider this. In the still days of early August, Sergeant MacNeil happened upon the skeletal remains of a human figure severed at the waist, about 100 yards from the water's edge, at Drinan Point. The two halves of this unhappy find were lying side by side on the shore. On an island where the pagan past is embedded deep in its very stones, it was an alarming artifact to come across. There are examples in the National Museum of bodies pulled from the Irish soil and from Irish bogs after thousands of years, cleaved in half during some kind of ritual sacrifice, perhaps of a local king whom the gods no longer favoured with bountiful harvests. But being a pragmatic man, Sergeant MacNeil's thoughts would have turned to a more recent tragedy. The year before, in January 1944, a Royal Air Force Catalina seaplane had crashed into Lough Erne off Boa Island while practicing a bombing run. 7 of the 10 crew lost their lives. At the inquest into the finding of the skeleton, Dr. Johnson could express no opinion on when or how the man, for it was a man, had died. Whether the bones were those of an ancient Irish warrior or king, somehow surfacing after thousands of years, or perhaps more likely of a World War II British airman. Well, it's an eerie thought in either case that their remains surfaced here, on this small island consecrated to the goddess of war, as though drawn to it by her malevolent will, reaching out across millennia. So it was in a perhaps disquieted frame of mind that Sergeant MacNeil found himself faced with another uncanny mystery just a few weeks later, this time within the walls of his own barracks. It was a fine barracks, as barracks go. It had once been the grand homestead of a prominent local landlord, and it sat in splendid isolation on a hillock at the end of a long, winding, tree-lined avenue. It was September. The war had been fully over for a matter of weeks, although many wartime privations, so the rationing, the shortages, still remained. But as peace of a kind descended at last upon a beleaguered world, chaos reigned in a corner of Fermanagh. This was no cozy Victorian-style ghost story. This wasn't creaking doors and figures half-glimpsed out of the corner of the eye. For a start, this was an unseen terror, or rather it was seen only once. But it was loud, it was destructive, and whatever it was, it seemed to be very, very angry. It all began, as these things so often do, innocently enough. The kind of thing that might be brushed off as a lack of sleep, a lapse of mind, a practical joke, perhaps. One day in mid-September, Sergeant MacNeil heard a series of knocks on his bedroom window. He lived at the barracks, and obligingly opened the door. He found nobody waiting on the threshold, but something did enter the barracks. You see, he heard it come in. Heavy footsteps echoed through the room. Of this, Sergeant MacNeil had no doubt. He saw nothing, but he heard the footsteps, all right. And they were the footsteps of someone or something that, if only he could have seen it, would surely have towered over him. Well, from that day forward, whatever the sergeant had unwittingly invited into the barracks became a permanent fixture. though not a constant one, the noises were heard on average every couple of weeks, noises that might have been explained away by the natural sagging and sighing of an old house, rattles in the floorboards, creaks on the stairs, except for one detail. Again, whatever was causing the creaks and the thuds must have been absolutely enormous. It wasn't simply warped wood settling back into shape. The house was quaking violently, as though under some massive weight. Something so big and so heavy that the walls of the house would literally shake from side to side whenever it began its terrifying tour of the barracks. When the Strabane Chronicle came to visit, its reporter found Sergeant MacNeil as cheery and as jovial as everyone had said, but entirely unwilling to talk about his experience. Other officers, cornered in private, were far more forthcoming. One imposing policeman reported that he had on many occasions gone dashing upstairs, torch ablaze, at the first stirring of the visitor, only to find absolutely nothing up there. Nothing he could see, that is, because footsteps, heavy, thumping footsteps, would pass him in both directions as doors whipped open and slammed shut of their own accord. The officer seemed convinced that this thing was a conscious entity in its own right, and he had come to the conclusion, as he solemnly informed the reporter, that he is best left alone. If only everyone in the barracks had been so circumspect. One night, an officer seated in the kitchen heard the now familiar sound of heavy footsteps resounding above his head on the upper floors. Thinking to have a little fun with the invisible visitor, the officer poked at the ceiling in response. Now, if we have learned one thing from these explorations of the unexplained, it is this. Whatever your beliefs, whatever your stance on the supernatural and the existence of a world beyond, there is one thing you should never, ever do. Should you encounter such a phenomenon, on no account should you do anything to provoke it. Hold fast to your faith or your skepticism, but for the love of God or whatever you believe in, leave well enough alone. Our officer quickly discovered why. The response was immediate. The thing above became suddenly frantic or enraged or both. It thundered through the house with incredible force and speed, its footsteps hammering through the rooms upstairs, shaking the entire barracks as though it were a doll's house, angrily slamming doors open and shut and making a sound like a heavy barrel being rolled across the floor, leaving, no doubt, a suitably chastened constable to swallow his cocoa and dive under the covers in terror. For months, the phenomena continued, albeit invariably heard and not seen. Sergeant MacNeil would routinely hear his suitcase being pulled from under his bed and bashed around his bedroom, only to find once he'd scrambled for his torch that nothing was out of place. The sound of crashing, smashing crockery and cutlery would resound from the kitchen. But again, the policemen who came running to investigate would find their cups, saucers and plates neatly stacked, perfectly intact, just as they'd left them. Indeed, the terror of letter barracks proved too much for some station personnel, two of whom demanded and received transfers from the barracks. So shattering was the experience. As is often reported in these cases, a domestic animal seemed to be even more sensitive than its human companions to these supernatural visitations. A small dog belonging to Constable Herdman, who was himself transferred back to Kesh Barracks in the middle of the hauntings, usually slept under the constable's bed while its owner was out on the beat. But every now and then, the dog would rush from its slumbering place into the orderly's room and sit shivering under the table. And invariably, every single time, the banging, pounding, and shaking would rock the barracks within seconds. Now, while many believe that animals can see through the veil of mortal perception, the tale of Herdman's dog suggests, to me at least, the possibility of a non-supernatural explanation of some kind. Animals can be extraordinarily sensitive to certain natural phenomena. Anyone who's ever been alerted to an imminent thunderstorm by a whimpering dog will tell you that. Could it be that the dog was reacting to some sort of natural or environmental event, perhaps a series of minor tremors, which would certainly have produced this shaking and thumping described by the RUC men? Well, Ireland is the least seismically active country in Europe, but the South Donegal North Fermanagh area is located on several active faults, and small earthquakes do sometimes occur there. Well, whether the events were natural, unnatural, or supernatural, it seems unlikely that this was a well-coordinated prank by the men stationed at the barracks, cooked up to pass the time in this remote and somewhat, they would have felt, hostile outpost of the new northern government. Cross-border relations were fairly cordial here, and members of the Free States police force, the Gardaí Síochána, as well as southern customs officials, were frequent visitors to the barracks, where they too heard and attested to the terrifying phenomena. If the men of the RUC had stopped searching for a cause, preferring to live and let live through gritted and chattering teeth, the local gossips and amateur historians had not given up the ghost. You see, the old-timers in the district, to them, none of these events were entirely new or entirely unsurprising. The house had an eerie reputation going back to its original owner, and when it was taken over by a local clergyman, it was said that the presence had confined itself to an attic. That was until the 1920s, when the building came to house another police force, an earlier police force, a unit of the Ulster Special Constabulary, a paramilitary body formed by the British government during the conflict of the 1920s. Perhaps unleashed by the prevailing atmosphere of tension and violence, the entity had begun to roam freely once more. It wasn't unique in this. I know of a very similar story, also dating from the War of Independence, which took place just 30 miles away in Swanland Bar. There, another notorious British paramilitary unit, the so-called Black and Tans, had set themselves up in the local police barracks. Not being local, they were unaware that the one room they couldn't access, well, that it had been sealed up for a very good reason. Having smashed the door down, the Tans found that they'd unleashed a ghost which had been locked up for 70 years. Thereafter, the ghost roamed the barracks and was often frantically fired upon by the furious and terrified towns, to no effect. It was still being seen long after the towns had departed, well into the 1940s. Now, I did promise you a sighting, didn't I? Well, there was only one at Letter, and it happened not in the house, but on that long, heavily shadowed avenue which led to the entrance, back in 1941. Two young men walking to the barracks encountered a figure standing still in the avenue in the moonlight, watching them approach. As they wished him a good night, the figure simply vanished into thin air. A little bit underwhelming, isn't it? Well, let's try this one, which arises from the local folklore about the house and concerns the nephew of the priest mentioned earlier, who was staying at the house before his uncle took possession of it. This nephew, it seems, awoke in the wee small hours one night to find something standing at the foot of his bed. It was not, in fact, an enormous, towering entity, but a small man with a goatee beard, watching patiently from the end of the bed. Well, I offer it merely as a coda, and if you're inclined to believe in leprechauns, then more power to you. But the haunting of Letter Barracks, the one witnessed, heard, and experienced by multiple sober and serious people, was certainly no joke. It remains one of the most enigmatic and best attested ghost stories in the entire Irish record. I suspect Sergeant McNeil and his men may have been quietly silenced by their superiors after the story made the headlines on both sides of the border just before Christmas, to the amusement of many. Thereafter, it faded from the public consciousness, if not from the nightmares of those who lived through it. Sergeant McNeil went back to his regular duties. Subsequent reports have him apprehending chicken thieves, petrol bootleggers, and doggedly investigating the theft of some chairs from the local YMCA. Today you will find no trace of Letter Barracks. It was closed not too long afterwards. The foreboding avenue that once led to the door is still there, but at the end of it, you'll find nearby a health spa. One wonders, however, if visitors luxuriating in its outdoor jacuzzi sometimes hear the heavy tread of footsteps in the grass. By the way, tales of haunted barracks, DMP barracks, Garda barracks, RIC barracks, Army barracks, are so numerous in Irish history that we could, if we so wished, fill an entire evening with them. I have among my files stories from Kappa in 1934, New Bliss in 1958, Mount Pleasant in 1891, Galway in the 1770s, Kildare in the 1940s. But since variety is the spice of life, let us pass on to another topic. Though not to another county, this next story is also a tale of County Fermanagh, specifically from the county town of Enniskillen, or rather from its rural hinterland. These events occurred about 3 miles from the town itself. This is one of the older stories in our catalogue, at least one of the older stories that doesn't belong to the realm of folklore and legend. This story was reported matter-of-factly in major Fermanagh and Belfast newspapers just before Christmas of 1829. Incidentally, it's notable that accounts of supernatural events and hauntings and restless spirits do tend throughout history to be reported with less skepticism in Ulster than in other parts of Ireland. And again, the account of this extraordinary event, claimed even in the Belfast newsletter, is entirely unquestioning. And it begins like this. In mid-December 1829, a young man who lived about 3 miles from Enniskillen was returning home late at night, along a dark and lonely road, when he encountered something in human shape coming his way. Terrifying it must have been, because the young man immediately fainted in the middle of the road. When he came to, some time later, he crawled to the nearest house and stammered out what he'd seen, still so affected by the encounter that he had to be carried home. When he did get home, he told the story again, and in short order, it spread to every fireside in the district. A few nights later, another young man was walking the same dark road at the same late hour and saw the same otherworldly figure. This young man was evidently of stronger character, because he did not faint clean away, but spoke to the apparition. He demanded, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, that the figure explain who or what it was, and what it wanted with him. And this the figure did. There in the moonlight, on that lonely stretch of road outside Enniskillen, the figure gave its name, or rather the name it had used in life, a life which had ended 6 months earlier. He, for he had been a he, could not rest until certain things were put right, and as far as what he wanted done, well, if the young man would meet him again, at a certain time and a certain place, he would tell him exactly what he needed done to allow him to rest in peace at last. Well, our brave young lad, undaunted in the face of this unearthly vision, agreed to meet the figure again at the appointed time and place. Would you have done the same, having survived one encounter with something not of this realm? Would you have volunteered for another? Perhaps I misjudge you, perhaps you would have. And perhaps you would take the rather sensible precaution that our intrepid young fellow of 1829 took, that is, to bring several hundred people with you. For that is precisely what happened. At the time and place arranged with the visitor from beyond, the young man, accompanied by two people who had known the spectre in life and hundreds upon hundreds of curious locals, turned up and waited upon the hour. And what, my friend, do you suppose they saw when that hour came around? As the chatter and the ribbing and the nervous laughter died down, and the distant church bells tolled the hour, what do you suppose the hundreds of observers, standing a respectful distance from the greeting party, actually saw? If you think they saw nothing, that the whole thing was a damp squib, well, you'd be wrong. As the Belfast newsletter's informant tells it, a man as sceptical as the night is long, we're told, the figure appeared, dutifully, punctually, at the promised time, and everyone saw it. Those who came to scoff and those who came to wonder, they all saw it. They saw the brave young man step forward, invoke the blessing and protection of God and hold a short conversation with the spirit. The young man was so affected by what he heard that he too now fell into a deathly torpor and had to be carried away by members of the terrified crowd. And that, so the Belfast newsletter insisted, was how the story rested on December 22nd, 1829, 3 miles outside Enniskillen in the county of Fermanagh. And as for what was said and what was done and whether it set the restless soul into peaceful repose, we shall never know. But such is the story, and now you have heard it. So, what do you think? Do you believe that several hundred of the good people of Enniskillen saw a ghost appear before their eyes, present its demands to a local youth, and dematerialize once again? Do you imagine that such an event, if it had occurred, would have lived on in the annals of Irish history rather than gathering dust in the yellowing archives of the Belfast newsletter? Or if you had been present and had seen what was purported to be seen, would you ever have spoken about it again, even to those who were there? That's something for you to contemplate when you're safely ensconced in your bed with the burdens of the day loosening around you. I have a strange feeling that some night soon, as you drift beyond the veil of conscious thought and into the realms of sleep, that you'll find yourself looking through the eyes of a member of that crowd, huddled together in the night, waiting for an apparition. And if that does happen, do please try to fix it in your memory and let me know. I think we're coming back to terra firma soon. Not a moment too soon either. You're looking a little green around the gills, if you don't mind me saying. Never mind. The night is drawing to a close. I'll tell you what. Why don't we have one final story, and why don't we choose something a little more contemporary? Let's swoop down from the border region to the southwest, to the county of Kerry. The village of Lixnaw is located in North Kerry. In English it's spelt Lixnaw, but locals pronounce it Lixnaw, which is much closer to its Irish name of Lechnava. Like many places in the southwest, Lixnaw is home to what is, by ancient tradition, a holy well with healing properties. People still go there to be cured today. The elaborate shrine features a really quite remarkable statue of the Archangel St. Michael skewering the devil with a spear. It's not a hugely accomplished work of sculpture, but it stops the viewer in its tracks. It's brightly coloured, and the likeness of the horned devil writhing in defeat is an incredibly lurid image to come across in the middle of the Irish countryside. Well, diabolical or not, in the winter of 1992, some dark force took possession of an ordinary house on an ordinary road in Clocher, Lixnaw. And this modern-day haunting, extraordinarily, was confirmed as genuine by the Catholic Church. Like quite a few modern-day hauntings, this one didn't take place in an old dark house groaning under the weight of all the souls who lived and died within its walls. This story concerns a brand new, modern, neat and tidy two-bed bungalow in Lixnaw. Shortly after moving into the bungalow, mother of two, Hannah, we'll draw a veil under her last name since the events are so recent, began to hear plaintive cries and wails, first from the backyard, and then, more disturbingly, from within the house itself. The noises continued month after month, as did the inexplicable behavior of the light fittings throughout the house, which would randomly switch themselves off without anyone even approaching them. Faulty wiring in a new house, it wouldn't be the first time, but shoddy workmanship could not explain the next terrifying manifestation, which sent Hannah fleeing from her home. "I had just turned off the light," said Hannah, "and I brought Clyde," that was her one-year-old son, "into the bed with me and squeezed him tight. The next thing, I was just closing my eyes when this ghost came. It was like a sheet thrown over a person. Well, no ambiguity there. Hannah was quite adamant that the entity which had invaded her bedroom was a ghost. And even if the reference to a sheet sounds somewhat corny, it probably won't in a moment or two. And bear in mind that we think of ghosts being clad in sheets because most corpses used to be buried in shrouds. If you're picturing a standard, stereotypical ghost from a child's drawing, you might need to think again." For Hannah continued, "It was huge. It was the breadth of a press, with eyes like bulbs that would dazzle you even if you had them closed. It came right up to me. The next thing, it pulled back the blankets and it started pulling the baby by the legs. I just held on the whole time. Well, understandably, after that, after having her baby menaced by this ghastly apparition, Hannah swiftly packed up and left. She fled to her parents' house, leaving locals to speculate on the cause of her troubles. According to local historians, the new house was located near the site where a medieval fort had once stood and may have been built directly over an ancient burial ground. If that sounds a little too convenient, a little too just so, the local parish priest had no such reservations. In fact, Father David McGilligott told the Evening Herald of his sincere belief that the house was inhabited by a wandering spirit. It's rare at any time to see such an endorsement from a member of the Catholic clergy. They tend to be quite cautious, if not outright skeptical, of such things as hauntings and possessions. But to encounter one as late as 1992, well, Father McGilligott must have been truly convinced that something nefarious was afoot in Clocher. Hannah's next move was not, however, one that would have been endorsed by the Catholic Church of any era. She invited the noted psychic Sandra Randani to cleanse her house of this wandering spirit. And this Sandra Randani apparently did. She spent 5 hours in the house one Sunday, communicating with the spirit in a semi-trance and telling it to move on to the next world. Ominously, Sandra said she sensed that the spirit was lurking around, waiting for the child to return. But now, she reported, the spirit had left, and the house was totally safe. And if anyone wanted a dose of the same treatment, incidentally, well, the following February, Sandra will be telling fortunes at the Grand Hotel in Tralee, price £12 or £10 unwaged. All's well. That ends well. Speaking of which, our journey has reached its end. I'm going to stay aboard for a while. The captain wants to consult me on a spiritual dilemma of his own. But you look like you're ready to clamber ashore once more. Give my regards to dry land. And do remember what I said about your dreams. You will dream about that apparition of 1829, though you may not remember. But if you happen to wake up in a cold sweat some night soon, or with an inexplicable sense of unease that follows you through the day, remember, and this is most important, you can protect yourself by... But no, you don't believe in such things, do you? Well, good night.